There's a saying I always like: Buddhist training begins with compassion for oneself. And compassion is the heart of seeing. It's the heart of meditation is compassion. We don't think of it. People kind of think of it more in terms of wisdom. But compassion is really the ability not to judge. To open your heart, let things in without judging. When you judge, you're not being compassionate. Thus, if you're with somebody in pain and you're judging them, that cuts down, you know, that's like, God, you shouldn't have done that. Not much, you know, that's not being compassionate. When you just are willing to open yourself to they're in this situation without that judgmental mind and just be willing to feel what's there. And just like, we don't picture Avalokiteshvara, you know, we don't figure the compassion that fills the universe is judging us. It's embracing the drunk, the murderer. Everything is embraced in the great compassion. And just seeing, just being open to it and feeling. And just, and again, with the non-judgmental mind, when there's something that can help, you naturally want to do it. You know, if somebody's in pain and I can help the pain, like somebody falls in the street in front of me, I don't say, oh, better keep going. You know, I'll hopefully, unless I'm scared, unless something else gets in the way, like a judgment, like I hear that there's something dangerous or something going on, you know, you'll help somebody. And compassion points us to the wisdom, which is the heart of Avalokiteshvara. Home to the one who leaps beyond all fear, having adored him, may I enter into the heart of the noble adored Kanzeon. You know, the fear that actually sees the unreality of the pain and suffering and just wants to help it, but isn't getting caught up in it. You know, it's like somebody was just trying to explain this point to someone of how to approach suffering, and they just kind of almost, what came out of them was like, how can you be at peace and accept, you know, like a child was just murdered? How could that be? And I go, okay, first of all, you want a world in which nothing bad happens to children. You know, it's like they can't have, it's like I know somebody who had an accident and killed their child, died from it. And you kind of go, wow, that's awful, but how can you picture a reality in which it's impossible to have an accident, you know, that causes, you know, that no children die? But if you feel something fundamental is lost in suffering, then you actually can't let go of it, because it's unacceptable that a child dies, unacceptable that they're suffering. And the scripture of Avalokiteshvara that we just chanted can be misleading in a way, just because it kind of almost speaks of it concretely helping you in all these situations, when actually the real help is to actually let go of what's in the situation so you don't feel bound by it. Because in the end, the flow of karma isn't going to stop. You know, just like no matter how much compassion wants to help me, I'm still going to fall apart and die. You know, there's nothing, you know, even if the execution doesn't get me, I'm still got, you know, death's going to come knocking. And when we don't feel compassion, again, that hard judgmental mind is stopping us from getting it. And one of the signs of it is that feeling of separateness and ill at ease, that non-acceptance, which is non-acceptance. You feel separate, disconnected, ill at ease, alienated. And what you're really alienated from is your own heart, the heart of Avalokiteshvara, which is actually more real than your own heart, which is just this flow of karma, which actually, if you let go of, isn't that important. I want this, I don't want that, this is good, this is bad. I'm actually going to use, as I had mentioned last week, talk about somebody in a concentration camp. I got this nice book about this woman, Eddie Helsom, and I saw some other Buddhist teachers had been using it as a, you know, a text for books just because she did so well. And she kind of said the problem in the concentration camp, I read this but I can't find the quote, is actually people's lack of inner preparation. You know, it's not what's happening then. It's the fact that somehow they're not prepared for life, which is true of people all over the place. It's why something bad happens and somebody actually can plunge into the deepest despair. And it's actually often sometimes not even a rather normal occurrence, like their boyfriend leaves them. It's like the world collapses when you think, doesn't this happen all the, you know, isn't this normal life? Why is this, and it's normal life to have a hard time with it, but why is the world collapsing? You know, and you realize it's how they're approaching it, and, you know, and not to be prepared spiritually, not to see reality, you know, which is inner preparation, is to be in touch with what's real. You know, even if you have a child, something bad could happen to the child. I mean, the nature is, you know, you're with luck, nothing bad happens, but something bad can happen. It's, you know, that's just the way things are. You can't make reality different. That it's almost like, I can remember people saying to me, I can't even, it would be completely unacceptable if something bad happens to my child. I just couldn't deal with that. And you realize lack of inner, you know, trying not to be in touch with reality. And then your heart isn't prepared really for suffering, you know, and is overwhelmed by, you know, overwhelmed by the suffering then when it comes. And, you know, and it's, and, let's see, and it's, and she says, it's possible to suffer with dignity. What I mean is, most of us in the West don't understand the art of suffering and experience 1,000 fears instead. We cease to be alive, being full of fear, bitterness, hatred, and despair. God only knows, it's easy to understand, and easy to understand why. But when we are deprived of our lives, are we really being deprived of very much? We have to accept death as part of life, even the most horrible of deaths. And don't we live an entire life, each of our days, and does it really matter if we live a few days more or less? You know, and I am in Poland every day on the battlefields, if one can call them. I see the visions of the poisonous green smoke, the crematoriums. I am with hungry, with the ill-treated and dying every day. But I am also with the jasmine and that piece of sky beyond my window. There is room for everything in a single life. When I say I've come to terms with life, it doesn't mean I've lost hope. What I feel is far from hopelessness, far from it. I have lived 1,000 times over already and I have died 1,000 deaths. No, it's a question of living minute by minute and taking suffering into the bargain. And this is certainly no small bargain these days. But does it matter if it's the Inquisition that causes people to suffer 1 century, wars, pogroms, to suffer senselessly, as victims put it? Suffering has always been with us. Does it really matter in which form it comes? All that matters is how we bear it and how we fit it into our lives. Am I merely an armchair theorist, safely ensconced behind my desk with my familiar books around me? I don't think so. And I bow my head under this great burden that bears upon me. But even as I bow my head, I also feel the need almost mechanically to fold my hands and pray. And I can sit for hours knowing everything and bear everything and grow stronger in the bearing of it. And at the same time feel sure that life is beautiful and worth living and meaningful, despite everything. But does that mean I'm always filled with joy and exaltation? I am often dog tired after standing in lines, but I know this too is part of life. And somewhere there is something inside me that will never desert me again. You know, in a way, she's describing finding the heart, you know, of Avalokiteshvara, you know, that won't desert her, and realize it's okay, even in the midst of what is really hard in life, which we all you know, come to face. You know, and it's and here she kind of goes something that's a good example of how to train. We must surrender all that is dearest to us in the enjoyment of the senses and go through a dark night in which we live without their help and comfort. Then, when this is accomplished, we have to sacrifice even our thoughts and our choices and undergo a still darker night deprived of familiar this supports. This is a kind of death. And when all has been strained away, our emptiness will be filled with a new presence. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do in our practice in meditation. We're not, you know, we're actually trying to do that whenever you meditate. You're not trying to hold on to your supports, what you want, what you don't want. And you're trying to bring that into your life of letting things go so we can be filled with what is real that allows us to bear. So we can be filled really, from a Buddhist point of view, with the heart of Avalokiteshvara, having adored him, or actually her, make it female just because it's nicer. You know, I mean, there's too many males. Let's have some equal opportunity bodhisattvas and Buddhas. And it's always a feminine figure, so... having adored her, let us enter into the heart of the noble adored Kanzeon. Her life is the completion of meaning. To find that heart that isn't moved, embraces everything but realizes it's okay, and the burden doesn't break it apart. And we have to trust that the suffering, if we are willing to embrace what happens to us, we won't break apart. Instead of our heart breaking, it will open and realize it's okay. You know, as this woman very nicely kind of says, because that's another. And she writes, you must be able to bear your sorrow even if it seems to crush you. You must be able to stand up again, for human beings are strong, and your sorrow must become an integral part of yourself. You mustn't run away from it. Do not relieve your feelings through hatred. Give your sorrow all the space and shelter in yourself that it is due. For if everyone bears their grief honestly and courageously, the sorrow that now fills the world will disappear. Yeah, and that's a very good teaching. You know, it won't crush you. You know, if you try to push it away, and it's like I was reading the diaries where she says, probably most people is they're working so hard not to see what's going on, not to be there. And she kind of quotes somebody. She said, so one woman was telling her, actually, it's not so bad in the barracks that she's in. There's all these people from the most fashionable street in Amsterdam living. So it's almost like she's living with, you know, kind of on, you know, on the Amsterdam equivalent of Park Avenue with these people. She, you know, and you kind of think, they're about to go to the gas chamber. You know, what is, you know? And she's still thinking in terms of, and the woman's just kind of like, I think dumbfounded that anyone could, in a way, be that superficial. And it's when we see the ways we can, I mean, that we have that heart in ourselves where we suddenly realize, why am I caring about something? So it's not like we don't do that. It's just in that extreme situation, it's painful to see someone who's so clinging to even social stuff. You know, you're about to die and die this really rough death and see everything go. And it's, and you're still clinging to, you know, to things like that. And, yeah.
Sometimes it's, though, I mean, along with that, sometimes it's so painful that we can, like, other places, not because. Maybe not because we're going so superficial, but it's so painful.
Oh yeah, no, it's not. Well, I'm definitely not saying superficial is the core. It's just at times that attitude. At times we are superficial in the sense, but at times, a lot of times it is, it's hard. And that's the inner preparation that we're, you know, you're coming, you're actually all here in a way for the inner preparation for, you know, if life's going to continue to be kind of really reasonable, why come here? You know, yet the trick, the same reason why we had 45 people, I remember, coming here right after September 11th, is suddenly I'm scared. I'm uncomfortable. What's my inner resources? Somebody was like telling me, you know, who comes here occasionally, and we're talking about parents, and, you know, he's just talking about old, you know, just the difficulty of getting old. And I said, well, that's why we train for it. He says, well, I don't think I'm spiritual enough to handle this. I say, that's why you practice. I mean, that's the whole point is, no, you know, you're doing the preparation. So when something happens, when the sorrow comes, the liberating things are just seeing things as they are. The joy is there. If you kind of, you know, right, you know, as the woman writes, right in the midst of the concentration camp, you know, there's I can't help it. This is the way it is, like some elemental force. The feeling that life is glorious and magnificent, and that we are building a whole new world. Against every new outrage and every fresh horror, we shall put up one more piece of love and goodness, drawing strength from within ourselves. We may suffer, but we must not succumb. It comes all down to the same thing. Life is beautiful. And I believe in God, and I want to say they're right in the midst, right in the thick of what people call horror, and still be able to wholeheartedly say, life is beautiful. You know, and this is not somebody who is not seeing what's going on. You know, she's, you know, not in a fog. You know, I never saw the movie Life is Beautiful, mainly because people told me they were almost trying to pretend they weren't in the concentration camp. And so some people had a, with this movie about somebody in a concentration camp, where it's almost like you can almost try to dream of not being there rather than fully be there and realize this is horrible. You know, this is both horror and the goods there. And it's like the woman wrote a very nice thing where she says, you know, she was in right before taking to the camps, you know, they were moved into a tiny section of the city, couldn't go into parks or anything else. And she writes, just looked up and there was the boundless sky and nothing's really limiting me, you know, and, you know, and the jasmine still smells and, you know, the perfume is still there, even though I'm, you know, you're stuck in this amazingly cramped quarter and you don't have to feel bound in our hearts by, you know, it's still the same sky overhead and nothing can bind us, you know, bind that. And of course, even without the sky, the boundless is in our hearts. So even if you're in a cell without the boundless sky, the boundless is still there if you don't feel the limitations. But it is, and going back to what Mary's saying, naturally, at times we're going to be overwhelmed by pain. So at times, our hearts can't seem to bear what it faces. And I'll meet people and I'll think, God, they're going to have, you know, this is, you know, it's like I've met people, I thought, oh God, this is very rough for what, for them to be able to do. And but the solution is still the same of working at that acceptance, working at letting go. It's the same medicine. It's just, at times it's going to be hard. And at times, you know, they don't have the strength, you know, they're due to karma. Maybe they're just not up to, it's going to overwhelm them. Just like, hell, the concentration camps overwhelm most people. It's not like there's that many, you know, I find these accounts, you know, people will find these accounts who are, it's not just me, other spirit, you know, they'll be used because there's such strong teaching of dealing with suffering. But, you know, when we're overwhelmed by suffering, the solution is the same. How, like coming back to the wall of meditation, you're not still, it's overwhelmed. Come back. Work at accepting, work at being at peace, work at letting go of what you feel is binding you. you know, work at not saying, not judging what is going on, but just being open to it. Watch what you tell yourself. This shouldn't be happening. This is wrong. This is unacceptable. All those judgments, close your heart to the boundless compassion, because you're saying, I want a different reality, and there's something wrong with this reality. I want a reality where children don't die. I want a reality that bodies aren't in pain. I want a reality that everyone's nice to each other. Which, without looking at how the suffering that fills the world still in you, you know, it's not out there. It's, you know, if the world's not at peace, have you taken responsibility of putting you at peace rather than thinking, I want everything else to be at peace, but it's okay for me to be kind of agitated and upset, because I'm less agitated than those other people. You know, almost like the way you can kind of think, well, I'm not doing big crime, I'm doing little. I'm just stealing office supplies, or I'm just being unpleasant to my children, but I'm not beating them. You know, I'm cheating on my wife, but she doesn't know, so it's okay. Which is all, you know, and this is in the hearts. You know, this is the way our hearts often work. I can have some ill will, and it's all the same stuff. Some have more consequences than the other, but it's our training to let go and have compassion and try to help karma wherever it is, and not make a distinction, really. Let's see these nice notes I have. Yeah.
It occurs to me that there's been two types. I mean, there's the compassion that you were mentioning, which means kind of suffering with the other person, right?
It's just being open to whatever, you know, is going on with the other person and feeling it, you know, opening your heart to it.
And pity, you know, people don't want pity, usually.
Well, pity's not the same. There's a judgment in pity that separates you from the other person. It's like, oh, they're just, how awful it must be to be disabled. Rather than just feeling the fact that this person is, and actually I've been around disabled people where you could pity them and they're doing better than the person pitying them. I mean, you know, their heart isn't actually open because the person actually is fine and you're thinking, oh, poor them, and they're doing okay. And the real, just being open to what they're going, but on the other hand, you can be, you know, so pity is different than compassion. The two are not the same thing. The pity separates you from it, while compassion, the way I'm defining it at least, because of course it's a word that can be defined other ways, but from a Buddhist point of view, compassion is just, is really being with what's there without judgment. And in pity there's a judgment and there's a separation. I'm not saying, wow, it's just pain and I want to help, you know, just like this person's having a hard time, it's not, and you're just willing to feel it and then naturally help, just the same way as if I'm in pain, you know, I would do something if I could help it.
You just can't do anything.
Yeah, often you have to just be there. You can't solve. It would be like, you know, somebody's an alcoholic. You can have compassion for them, but you can't stop them from drinking, you know.
I have a real problem like this at the moment. My brother is being diagnosed as having dementia. Mm-hmm. And so his wife is very desperate. She, you know, tries to take the children away and all that. And he thinks she is a devil. You know, she wants to destroy him.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what one can do, you know?
Yeah, it's hard. And that's a... Yeah, and it's... And it's very painful. I mean, it's...
I guess one can just listen.
You listen, you just do your best, you listen, and you realize that you can solve suffering. It's, and the acceptance of the fact that this person just, there's just this suffering, and there's no way out. Same way in the concentration camp, the woman couldn't, you know, there wasn't a way out, but you can still be try to be at peace with and realize it's nothing's fundamentally going wrong. It's just some of these people are going to go through a very difficult time. I mean, it's not as bad with my mother, but in the sense that she doesn't, but a lot of the suffering is still there. You know, she's still upset and, you know, gets and all the rest and gets irrational and you just have to, what? No. So it's not your situation. I don't know the details, but it sounds like it could be worse than my mother's, but I'm just saying, but on the other hand, it's the same. It's still suffering. And you just realize, you know, just like my poor father who died last year, you know, it's, you know, there he is, you know, 91 years old dealing with this wife with dementia who's getting angry a lot. And you just think, oh God, this, you know, and he just had a good attitude of mind with most of the time. He was just said, okay, this is what I need to do. And just do your best. And if it gets to be too much, she'll have to, he just said, I don't know, if I can't do it, I can't do it. I'll just do my best and just take it, you know, one step at a time. And it, but it's hard and it's suffering and there's nothing, you know, and that's very, you know, very difficult suffering, and actually the karma of the person, the training that the dementia person had, usually has a tremendous impact on the dementia, because my experience in dementia, which isn't that extensive, so take it with a fact that I may not know what I'm talking about. Always keep that in mind. I've had a little more experience with meditation, so you know, there's some things I know a little more than others. But as I've noticed, that actually what the karma of the person, the patterns that they have, the fears, the desires, all now get highlighted in dementia, because it's almost like the filter of the mind that knows what's appropriate and reasonable goes away, and you're left with much more open fear, you know, both the good and bad karma actually there. And I can see, and I've seen this in other people, I can see it quite clearly in my mother, the things that she always had trouble accepting now are much worse, because the mind no longer filters the acceptance. It used to be what she wanted didn't make sense, but she kind of knew enough to be more reasonable than what she felt like, you know, she was scared about something, and you kind of, or you know, so her irrationality and her unreasonableness or her hard opinionation, the things that she didn't trust, the things that she was scared of, are all much, much worse now. And her good qualities are really a huge help, because some of her good qualities, that's like lifesavers to her, because, you know, she actually has a reasonably positive attitude of mind. So a lot of the time she's just, you know, she's actually telling herself the right thing to do. Like, I have to just, you know, just kind of accept what's, you know, kind of do my best and let go and just realize this is difficult, you know, just, and she's often telling herself really the right thing to do, and then just gets confused and over, you know, and both things come up, like she'll get really angry and then realize, okay. But it's hard, and we have to realize that it's just, this is the nature of things. Suffering isn't, any, you know, suffering is, you know, yet unless we, if you want to hold on to things, you will suffer. You know, if you want things a specific way, there's suffering involved, and, you know, the liberation comes from, you know, letting, you know, from really doing this inner preparation, this work. You know, by suffering I learned to accept that I have to share my love with the whole of creation, with the entire universe. But this love also gives us access to the universe within ourselves. But the admission ticket is costly and hard to get. Only with blood and tears can one save enough to afford one. You know, kind of the ticket of, you know, it takes a lot. You know, we have to make a real commitment if we want to, you know, if we want to free ourselves, it takes, you know, it's, we have to make it a priority. It's kind of, it's not going to happen, you know, if we drift through life wondering, okay, it'll sort itself out. I'll be able to handle suffering better by just getting older. Be around old people. You know, it's not a solution. You know, some wisdom comes with, can come with age, but actually a lot of times we just solidify our delusions. You know, the way you get set in your ways, it's like, this is, you know, and that's very true about a lot of people. If you're not careful, as you get older, you just get, the mind gets more hard and set. We know nothing about, in this burning of the self, and she was talking earlier about burning, we are asked with clear presence and mind, with courage and surrender, to give ourselves completely to the unknown. We know nothing about this unknown in this unpredictable moment, except that in meeting it, and she's really talking about meeting whatever unfolds next in our life, which is actually unknown when we think we know it, but it actually isn't. That's the way we're deluded. We think we know, like life's predictable, controllable, and we have a handle on it. And the world's full of people who think they have a handle on life. And then they're completely thrown when something happens. It's like, how's this happening to me? How can I have cancer? I mean, like, you know, it's like, and I was talking to one of my relatives who just had something that may have been a serious health condition. You know, they passed out a few times, and they just, and it's one of those things, okay, you're passing out a few times. And they were just like, I could be dying. You know, it was like, the fear and the, it's like, this is unacceptable, was coming up for them. And I'm just kind of going, you know, it's okay. Just take it step, you know, just, you know, the Dharma teaching. But of course, since they weren't practicing, there's nothing much I could say because I can't tell them. In fact, I would just drive them crazy. Like my sister, I like telling when she came to Vesak a year ago, and I kind of smiled because I hadn't even heard it, where she said at Vesak she piped up after I was talking, gave me a story of her, that I was driving her daughter around, my niece, and we took her to Muir Woods. She was in the area. She's a reporter and was working for the Chronicle, and took her to the, in Washington, she was based in Washington, and I took her to Muir Woods, and she was having to catch a plane, so we're, it's a Sunday, actually, after doing this class, I met her and took her to Muir Woods and going to drive her to San Francisco, where she was going to pick up her stuff and go to the airport. Well, we hit what's not unusual. We're on the freeway, and we're not moving. And I kind of turned to her without, and I should have been more sensitive to this, but I guess I'm used to being around, I'm spoiled by the fact that I guess I'm too used to talking to people, you know, in terms of the Dharma. So I kind of smiled at her and said, well, it's good, we'll have a chance to talk. You know, we're not moving in traffic, you know, we're in this nice car and we get some more time together. And I mean, it wasn't actually that, it wasn't like close to missing the plane either. It wasn't, it wasn't looking like there was any reasonable possibility of us not making it. We had left ourselves with plenty of time, so there was no, I wasn't really concerned she was going to miss her plane, but we were just stuck in traffic, and it was going to be, and so it wasn't like that type of fear, which even I can, you know, have great sympathy for, in the sense, if I'm stuck in traffic and I'm going to miss my plane, my address, you know, it's like I'm feeling like, oh God, do I want to deal with this? Like, you know, because I've experienced that, but it was just kind of cute, and she didn't say anything, but she just told my sister I drove her crazy. And I thought to myself, and I thought, probably wasn't skillful, you know, I just kind of, you know.
What are you going to do? You're stuck in traffic.
I know, but I actually had to have more sympathy for the fact that she was having a hard time with it, rather than kind of just doing what I often say in classes, you know, you can't move, just relax and accept it. Well, the world's not full of people who don't mind, you know, and actually at times I'm one of those people. So, you know, that's why I give this teaching, as I suddenly pick up in myself, you know, God, why isn't the traffic moving, and getting frustrated, and yeah.
I think I'm at a phase, sort of between phase, where sometimes I'm certainly not using skillful means with other people who talk about, you know, that dramatize the things that are happening to themselves or others, you know, that they're perfectly normal. It happens all the time with my mother. And it's, you know, it is that same thing. How can, you know, such a devastating thing happen? I mean, and then I don't, you know, I sort of don't, haven't figured out how to respond or not respond, but, you know.
Often you just have to try to have sympathy for the person and just realize this is hard, you know, instead of how can it happen? God, this is, you know.
So you're talking about other people?
Other people, or, yeah,
like,
well.
That must have been absolutely devastating, you know, I mean, you know, and it doesn't match up at all.
Oh.
You know, like, I mean, you just go, it doesn't matter which subject, it'll be, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And like a person she knew started going blind at age 40, and then I think at 70 she moved into my mother's retirement facility. And actually the individual was fantastic. She learned Braille, she got, you know, learned blind skills, she got, you know, the cane, and totally independent, you know, and but she'll say, It must have been absolutely devastating, you know.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, you have to just,
well,
you listen, and you just have to find what's useful to say that'll get through and help the person, and just sometimes point out the person actually seems to be have done really well with it. And it's an example that you can actually be happy. You know, there's, you know, people sometimes can actually be doing better when they're blind or something than when they're not, you know, and, you know, that it doesn't, you know, but yeah, it's just every individual's different, so it's one of those things you can't.
But I think I'm actually not practicing well because I cease to be compassionate to the person that's kind of going on.
Yeah, so. But, yeah, and, yeah, well, that's kind of normal too, so you have to remember, instead of, you know, have compassion for yourself, the fact that you're finding it hard, and this is your mother who's being judged, you know, and we have those expectations and patterns of karma with people where we actually don't see them as just somebody. We don't see our parents typically just as a normal person having karma. We see them through this cloud of judgments of how we, you know, just like when, how we wish they would be. Thus, I know I always had much less patience with my mother than with most other people, because it's my mother, and didn't see her as clearly as, and it's funny how much we don't see them just as who they are, but see them through that filter. I mean, what I've sometimes mentioned is, I remember talking to my sister and I said something very obvious about my mother, and it was a revelation to my sister, who's actually very sharp and perceptive, bright, sharp, reasonably perceptive person, and it was her mother, and she never looked at her like just she would anybody else, and something very obvious about her never registered, because it was the mother, and she saw it just a cloud that never thought of her in those terms. And once I did, she said, oh, I guess that would be the case. And and it was just funny because it would be obvious if you saw her, if you met her and just had a conversation with her, this would be an obvious point, but you wouldn't know if, when it's your mother, it's so close that you don't see it, the same way as we often don't see our own karma very well. Everybody else can kind of, you know, it's the thing you always have with people. Everyone else can see something clearly, and the person's in the middle of it, and they don't have a clue. You know, it's like you even know what they're going to do, and they don't have a clue. They're making this deep decision, and everybody knows what they're going to do. And then, you know, they're struggling, but you know, you all know what they're going to end up doing. And you just have to have compassion for yourself and just try to do better. And a lot of things are hard for us to have to deal with. And, you know, lots of things, you know, you'll just won't have patience for. You'll just think, I don't want to. God, how could, you know, our opinions will come up. How can somebody be like, you know. And, you know, lots of situations come up where I suddenly aware of this flow of opinionation kind of bubbling out of me. Like, just some karma coming up, you know, just kind of a defilement moving through me that I have all this hardness and opinions and non-acceptance, criticism. Why is this person that way? I mean, that comes up. I mean, that's going to come up in everybody. You know, something happens and you'll just, instead of being compassionate, you'll just go, God, that's really dumb. How could somebody be like that? Okay. So, you know, you don't quite have the heart of Avalokiteshvara yet. Yeah. And that's all right. And, you know, you work at it when you see it. And the acceptance of, you know, she writes here, living and dying, sorrow and joy, the blisters on my feet and the jasmine behind the house, the persecutions, the unspeakable horrors, it is all as one in me, and I accept it all as one mighty whole. You know, and that's what will liberate us. You know, where we're not cutting reality. Think of the opposite, what you do when you don't do that. You're cutting reality into pieces. I want this piece. Let me get rid of that piece. And this is what we all do. You know, we cut our lives, our worlds up. You know, I want blue state people, not red state people. I want this and not that. This is good. And realizing liberation is going to come when we... You know, and the liberation comes, accepting as a mighty whole, comes, as she writes here, sustained by the certain knowledge that ultimately they cannot rob us of anything that matters. You know, which is, you know, the gas chambers won't rob you of anything that matters. Actually, the woman even made an interesting choice. People, she's in the, you know, in Amsterdam, a Jew. People wanted to hide like Anne Frank. And she said, no. You know, it's for me, I shouldn't be separate from everyone else. You know, this is just part of it. Birth, death, whatever's going on, I'm part of it. And it's okay. And people were, you know, she was an impressive figure. So people were thinking, you have too much to offer. She says, death won't take anything away. You know, there's nothing's going to be lost in death. And I'm part of this, and I don't think I should be separating myself from what the whole large community was going through. I mean, they were going to just... What?
Do you know how old she was?
She was 20... She died at 29.
Oh,
you know,
did she
and...
Did she have a religious training, or this sort of just this attitude being natural to her?
She didn't do a lot of practice. You know, she had done some readings, had somebody who was actually her... somebody she was involved with romantically who was quite spiritual and somehow had her do things, and she had read, she even had a thing, she grew up Jewish, and she said she read a number of Christian works that helped her a lot. You know, I don't think she became actually even Christian, but absorbed a lot of it. And she said, the key thing for me is I had to learn to kneel. In my tradition, there's no kneeling. And it's the equivalent of bowing, you know, getting down on your knees and recognizing that there's something bigger than you. And she said, that was essential. I had to learn to kneel. And from a Buddhist point of view, you know, it would have been, somebody should have shown her how to bow, but in the end, it was the same thing. She had to get down on her knees and bow. And, yeah, it's, You know, and she, I've looked at our destruction, our miserable end, straight in the eye and accepted it into my life. And I continue to grow from day to day, even with death staring me in the face. For my life has become extended by death. And she writes somewhere else, you know, like, that there's no difference between my death and everyone else's death. You know, it's just death. It's around us all the time. And, you know, in a way she was pointing out to no self, you know, that there isn't really, that there's nothing special about me. I'm just, you know, and there's nothing special going on in birth and death. Anyway, nice.